Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is God's Gumshoe, and this is an investigation into the New Testament Bible. We're continuing with our investigation into the miracles of Jesus, and in dealing with that debate in particular. In any discussion of this debate, it's important that we begin to understand the language of the miraculous in dealing with the supernatural versus the natural, and how this plays and what part this plays in religion. So far in this debate, in previous episodes, we've talked about David Hume, the acknowledged philosopher whose first early opinions really laid the groundwork for the natural and the supernatural and the miraculous. This was answered by Dr. John Lennox, the mathematician from Oxford, in his discussions in Oxford and in his debate with Christopher Hitchens, who wrote the book, God is Not Great. Today, we're going to continue with that investigation and into that debate with our first discussion that comes from The Bill Maier Show. Here, New York Times columnist Ross Douthart, appearing on Bill Maier's show, promoting his book, Bad Religion, discusses the supernatural, the natural, and this aspect of it. We'll follow this again with Dr. John Lennox in a quiet conversation rather than a lecture, and then we will continue with our investigation of the New Testament miracles and the corresponding perspective coming from the Urantia Papers. Let's join the conversation. Here, Bill Maier, talking about the supernatural with Ross Douthat from the New York Times and what it means about the supernatural, the miraculous, and the whole aspect of religion. Let's have a listen.
They had to go someplace else.
All right, so let's talk about your book, first of all, because religion, obviously a pet topic of mine.
A pet topic of yours. I was thinking about you the whole time I was writing
I'll
it, Bill.
I'll bet you.
Every day and every night. Because this is a book about what happened to American Christianity in the last 50 years.
Right.
And the good news for you, as an atheist, an occasional critic of organized religion, is that organized religion, weaker than ever before.
Yes.
Right? You know... I see some members of the audience, think that's good news. So,
yes.
You know, mainline Protestantism, steep decline, my own Catholic Church, racked by scandal and so on. But here's the bad news, both for Christians like myself and for critics of religion like yourself. Americans are still as religious as ever. You dig into the polling numbers, more people claim a direct experience of the divine than they did in the 1950s. People are still as likely to say they believe in God and so on. If you drop below, you know, do you go to church on Sunday and ask what do people actually believe, religion's as potent as ever. So what are we if we're no longer a traditionally Christian nation but also not yet a nation of Bill Maher's? And my answer is that we have a word for religion, you know, religious faith that is still deeply influenced by Christianity but isn't traditionally Christian, and we're a nation of heretics. And the bad news is that everything that you hate, that you really hate about religion, is embodied by the faiths that have risen as institutional Christianity has declined. So, you know, prosperity preachers, Joel Osteen, self-help gurus,
Deepak.
The Deepak Chopras, and so on.
Yeah.
So this is in a way,
right.
It's bad news for both of us.
You say that you criticize both sides. You say the right, they've hurt religion because they've made it anti-intellectual, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think.
But isn't all religion? I'm not insulting here. I'm just saying.
No, you're just describing.
It is by its very nature anti-intellectual.
Well,
let me
give you an example, right? So, I think a person like yourself looks at religious history and says, okay, once upon a time, Christians all took Genesis literally, right? And then science came along and said, well, you can't take Genesis literally anymore. And so you've got half of Christians who are, you know, going to Ken Ham's Creation Museum and sort of clinging to that. And then you've got the sort of, you know, moderate Christians who are sort of doing some funny dance and not really owning up to reality. But the truth is that the idea that you take Genesis literally as like, you know, six literal days of creation is pretty much a modern invention. Fundamentalism starts in the late 19th century. The idea of the rapture, right, where everybody's lifted out of their shoes, that's an early 20th century innovation. If you go back and look at ancient Christian authorities, they're looking at Genesis the same way you are, and they're saying, look, this obviously
isn't... you're giving yourself license to say that some of the Bible is bullshit.
No, I'm giving myself license to say that if you read the Bible, if you actually look at the first few books of Genesis, whoever wrote the Bible clearly didn't mean to say this is a scientific account of creation, and actually serious Christians have known that all the way back to the first century
AD. Okay, well, you know, I always say the Bible is
I like you.
The Bible, you know, divided into the crazy and the wicked. You know, you're saying the crazy...
I'm going to take a drink of water on that.
I mean, but the Bible does say, you know, it's funny, it says, you know, this is 100% true. The Bible says you have to take it like that. Now, if it's not 100% true, I would say the whole thing falls apart. But okay, let's say it's okay to say the crazy stuff. We don't take that literally. What about the wicked stuff? You know, at the end of Religulous, I say if you belong to a social club that contained as much violence, anti-women, anti-homosexuality, just plain wiping out people, genocide for no reason, you would probably resign from that social club.
I think a lot of the question about sort of religious history, right, in part it comes down to your view of human nature. If you think human nature is, you know, pretty much okay, and then you look at religion, you say, well, here comes this force telling people to believe in their sky fairies and their flying spaghetti monsters and so on, and it's, you know, it's yes. Taking people and it's making them kill each other and so on. On the other hand, if you think, as I do, and I think it's borne out by a lot of empirical evidence, that people are mostly pretty shitty to each other most of the time, independent of whether they're religious or not, then you look at religious history and you say, well, wait a minute, okay, yeah, obviously it's justifying genocide here, but people commit genocide without resorting to religion for justification. What's interesting is the moments when religion comes in and lifts us up.
That's
right?
Not quite true. Actually, the opposite is true. Someone once said, to have a normal person commit a horrible act almost never happens without religion. For have people get on a plane and fly it into a building, it had to be religious.
I think what's true is to get a normal person to commit a crazy act, it does take ideas, right? It has, but those ideas can be secular as well as religious. A lot
but
of normal
mostly,
people did...
Mostly in history they
Not in
religious.
The 20th century, not in the Soviet Union. A lot of dead bodies there.
Right.
Not well, a lot of Christians, except among the dead bodies.
I would say that's a secular religion. But all right, I'm going to ask you one more question before we move on, because I could talk about this all night.
And
you're a...
and for all
you're a very good
too.
Sparring partner. But so, but here's my one question. I mean, the question that begins the Religious movie is, how can otherwise very intelligent people, and that's why I'm glad you're here, because that you certainly qualify. Again, you wrote that column for the New York Times when you were 9.
It was a good year.
How can otherwise intelligent people believe in the talking snake? You must know, because you're a student of history, that other civilizations had supernatural gods, and we know now that they're myths, or we could describe them as myths. We think Zeus is a myth. We certainly think Thor is a myth. We now have supernatural gods. You must, the rational part of you, see that pattern there.
Right. The pattern is...
The rational
part of your mind must see that pattern.
The pattern is this,
right? People find themselves in a mysterious and mysteriously orderly universe. They find themselves equipped with sort of intense moral instincts, and they have religious experiences, and they develop systems that explain those. And over time, Christians think that God, you know, intervenes and sort of reveals himself, and that's why we have sort of progress in religion. But even, I think the point I would make, Bill, is just, you know, you ask how an otherwise intelligent person can believe in something metaphysical. But human beings are believing animals, period. You were talking about secular religions. Even, you know, secular liberals have their, you know, where are human rights, right? What is the idea of universal human rights if not a metaphysical principle? That you can you find universal human rights under a microscope? Is it in the laws of physics?
I would say the laws of common sense, which I certainly would not put virgin birth.
Thousands of years.
But okay. All right. I'll ask you one more simple question. Were you for killing bin Laden when Obama did that?
Yes.
Because certainly, if you read the New Testament, on many pages, Christ says, do not repay evil with evil. Do not kill your enemies. Turn the other cheek. Tell me how you lawyer your way out of that. How can you be for something that your Savior, the guy you emulate and want to follow, when he says specifically so many times, do not repay evil with evil, do not kill your enemies, turn the other cheek. How is killing Bin Laden? Now, I'm for killing.
I think the thread that runs through the New Testament is, you know, there's also a...
But you know those quotes.
Well, there isn't a quote that says, you know, civil authorities have no right to kill a mass murderer if he's guilty of mass murder. There are quotes for sort of, in ordinary life, Christians are supposed to turn the other cheek. But Jesus was pretty friendly with a lot of Roman soldiers. And there was Christianity has always developed a just war tradition that says there are situations where, again, civil authorities, not you or I going off with a machete in, you know, the northwest frontier, have the right to preserve civil order.
It's like a very, very specific reading of that. Okay. Let's move on to...
So this gives us a pretty good idea of where this debate is at. Now, to notch up our understanding of the supernatural and the discussion of the miraculous and how science and religion do this, we now bring back Dr. John Lennox from Oxford, the Oxford mathematician, who is speaking again at the Harvard University, and his ideas on science, religion, the supernatural, the miraculous, and God. Let's have a listen.
Science and religion, but there are different religions. Now, this is an immensely important question, because leaving Christianity outside altogether, religions do not agree with each other. It's idle to pretend that they do. Science is an international discipline. And of course, we are all aware of the sad fightings, even within Christendom, in my own country of Northern Ireland. So, I've got a lot to answer for, in a way. And how do I approach this question? Well, in exactly the same way as everything else. I find, let's take the three great monotheistic religions. I have many Muslim friends and Jewish friends. Many parts of the world. And when it comes to the resurrection of Jesus, there are three different views, as you know. The Jews believe, my Jewish friends believe, that Jesus died and did not rise. My Muslim friends believe he didn't die. And I believe that he both died and rose. They cannot all be true. How do you approach a question like that? Well, first of all, I step completely back from it. And I realize that there are two levels of difference between religions. And the first thing to recognize, ladies and gentlemen, as you go around the world, study all religions or none, people of any faith, philosophy you care to name, you'll find a striking fact. And it's that there's a common element of morality that's shared by almost every living human being. I've done a bit of research on this. And you will find the golden rule, do unto others as you would be done by, in every single religion, in every single philosophy, even Roman pagan philosophy, and in the fundamental statement of British humanism. You will find it everywhere. What does that tell me? It tells me that we need to respect each other's ethical code. Sometimes as a Christian, I can be put to shame by the moral integrity of someone of another religion. And therefore we approach this with great sensitivity. So that's the first thing. But what I notice is this, ladies and gentlemen, that the real difference comes not at the level of ethics and morality, so much as at the level of the basis on which a person can have a relationship with God. And there, religions and philosophies divide into two systems. One of the systems is a bit like Harvard University. There is an entrance examination. I presume you have an entrance, do you? Or do you just get in without an exam? No, you don't. So there's an entrance exam, so we can imagine that as a door here. And then there's the Harvard way, and it goes up and down, and you try and stay on it, and there are all the professors to teach you, and then there's a whacking great gate at the end. It's called final exam. Now, the whole principle on which the system depends is that of merit. The professors, all of them, are infinitely kind. And, but, I hope they are anyway. But they cannot guarantee that you're going to get through the door at the end, can you? It depends on merit. Your performance. Your achievement. And many religions are like that, and their adherents tell me they're like that. There's some initiation rite. You get on the way, you try to follow the way, and you hope that then when the great assessment comes and your good deeds are measured against your bad deeds, that somehow the good ones will weigh more than the bad ones and you will be accepted into whatever is beyond. I know that's a slight caricature, but it's what many people believe. It's what many Christians actually believe. Now, I do not believe that at all. Because, ladies and gentlemen, the unique thing, it seems to me, about Christian faith is it's not based on merit. Because it does have a gate in a way. But at the beginning, there stands Jesus Christ, who claims to have come into the world to die for my sin. Now, that's a very ugly word to raise in Harvard, but you did ask me about religions, so I'll have to give you the answer that I believe is the true one. In other words, let me put it this way. Suppose I did, my first day at Cambridge, I saw a beautiful girl. I married her eventually. Now, suppose I went to her and said, Sally, you know, I'd like to marry you, but here's a cookbook. Now, it's got a whole lot of rules inside it. Now, if you keep those rules fairly well, for the next 30 or 40 years, I will think about accepting you. Of course, I couldn't possibly accept you now. But if you perform well enough, when the final assessment comes, I will accept you. Well, some of you are laughing. Others of you might be experiencing that. I don't know. But that would be to insult her. The secret of my marriage, ladies and gentlemen, is this, that we accepted each other at the beginning, unconditionally. And because she doesn't have to keep the rules of the cookbook, so to speak, in order to gain my acceptance, that sets her free to learn to come. And it's exactly the same with God. We wouldn't dream of basing our relationship with a fellow human being on a measured performance and an acceptance at the end of a long history of performing laws. And yet millions of people think that that's a way to base a relationship with God. And it seems to me here, and let me say it straight, Christianity competes with no other religion here. Because as far as I can see, Christ is the only person that offers me the knowledge of forgiveness right here and now. So in my life, I try to live for him, not in order to gain his acceptance, but because, ladies and gentlemen, I already have it. It's not based on my performance or my merit. It's based on the merit of Jesus Christ, who died and rose for me. And there, ladies and gentlemen, I think we'll have to leave it. Thank you for your patience.
For more information about the Veritas Forum, including additional recordings and a calendar of upcoming events, please visit our website at veritas.org.
Thank you, Dr. Lennox. Now, let's carry on with the investigation into the miracles of Jesus. In his book, The Miracles of Jesus, Michael Simons Roberts examines many of Jesus' miracles in the context of first century Galilee. He reveals that Jesus' miracles were full of hidden meanings and shows how, by cracking this ancient code, we can come to a deeper understanding of who Jesus of Nazareth really was. A healer? A prophet? Or the long-awaited Messiah and Son of God? The ancient accounts in the New Testament Bible tell us that Jesus could calm storms with a word, feed thousands with a few scraps of bread and fish, walk on water, cure the sick, and even raise people from the dead. Today, the question is how. In this enlightening book, which is an official tie-in to the major BBC three-part series called Hidden Meanings, The Miracles of Jesus, Raghay Omar, a well-known Middle East journalist and a historian, takes us through these miracles and brings to us the scholar's perspective. So today, we're going to do something just slightly different. Now, all of these miracles are very well known. And so, after each of these presentations by Mr. Omar, we'll follow this up with a reading from the biblical perspective upon this particular miracle, and then from the perspective of the Urantia Papers on that same miracle. Let's have a listen.
Groups and worldview of first century Jews. It's the Dead Sea Scrolls that can provide us with the true meaning of the miracles of Jesus. This is a copy of one of the scrolls, and the documents reveal that in the first century, Jews believed they were in the midst of a holy war between good and evil. The forces of evil were the Romans occupying Israel. The Roman occupation was brutal. The historian Josephus writes that in one instance, they crucified 1,000 Jewish rebels at the same time. Roman rule also expressed itself in idolatry and loose morals, and that was pushing many Jews away from devotion to God. And yet, the scrolls show that the Jews were hopeful that the rule of God would return, so much so that they believed that a new age of freedom and righteousness was imminent. They even had a sense of how their victory would come about. First, a great prophet would come, and he would reproach the religious authorities, just as Elijah had done centuries earlier. Now, when you look at it in this context, Jesus' miracle at Nain takes on a whole different meaning. You see, the Jews believed that Elijah had never died, but had been taken to heaven in a chariot of fire. Some believed that Elijah would return to herald the new age of peace. In bringing the widow's son to life again, the crowds believed that Jesus was taking on the mantle of Elijah and announcing the return of the rule of God. It made Jesus' actions highly political, an incredibly dangerous thing. As critics of the establishment, prophets were treated mercilessly. Many were flogged, tortured, or stoned to death. I'm going back to the places he lived and examining the Bible accounts of the miracles he's said to have performed to try and get inside his mind. I want to know, did Jesus really believe he was the Son of God?
Thank you.
The miracles of Jesus are amongst the best known and best loved stories in the world. Turning water into wine. Casting out demons. And calming a violent storm. And we know about these dramatic events because they were written down within 60 years of Jesus' death by the writers of the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. But we live in a rational age. We associate miracles with either medical advances or bizarre coincidences. And it makes us wary about biblical stories speaking of God intervening in the world. It is a nice idea, but surely it can't have happened like that. But whether we believe in miracles or not, Jesus' world of the first century was very different. For people then, miracles were part of the fabric of life. Medical technology was primitive, and for those who were sick, an act of God was often their only hope. Jesus lived here, in the village of Capernaum, on the shore of the Sea of Galilee, and archaeologists have traced these very stones right back to that period. And if the Gospels are to be believed, they've borne witness to some extraordinary scenes, because it's here that Jesus is said to have performed nearly half of all his miracles. The Gospels contain records of over 35 miracles, and of these, the majority were healings of the lame, the deaf, and the blind. Archaeological evidence from the time revealed that mortality rates were high, especially amongst children. And scholars claim that on any given day, a quarter of the population was sick, disabled, or in need of medical attention. In a society like this, a healer was held in high esteem.
Paper 149, The Second Preaching Tour. The second public preaching tour of Galilee began on Sunday, October 3, A.D. 28, and continued for almost 3 months, ending on December 30. Participating in this effort were Jesus and his 12 apostles, assisted by the newly recruited corps of 117 evangelists and by numerous other interested persons. On this tour they visited Gadara, Ptolemais, Japhia, Dabarita, Megiddo, Jezreel, Sepphopolis, Tarakia, Hippos, Gamala, Bethsaida Julius, and many other cities and villages. Before the departure on this Sunday morning, Andrew and Peter asked Jesus to give the final charge to the new evangelist, but the Master declined, saying that it was not his province to do those things which others could acceptably perform. After due deliberation, it was decided that James Zebedee should administer the charge. At the conclusion of James's remarks, Jesus said to the evangelists, "Go now forth to do the work as you have been charged, and later on, when you have shown yourselves competent and faithful, I will ordain you to preach the gospel of the kingdom." On this tour, only James and John traveled with Jesus. Peter and the other apostles each took with them about one dozen of the evangelists and maintained close contact with them while they carried on their work of preaching and teaching. As fast as believers were ready to enter the kingdom, the apostles would administer baptism. Jesus and his two companions traveled extensively during these 3 months, often visiting two cities in one day to observe the work of the evangelists and to encourage them in their efforts to establish the kingdom. This entire second preaching tour was principally an effort to afford practical experience for this corps of 117 newly trained evangelists. Throughout this period and subsequently, up to the time of the final departure of Jesus and the 12 for Jerusalem, David Zebedee maintained a permanent headquarters for the work of the kingdom in his father's house at Bethsaida. This was the clearinghouse for Jesus' work on earth and the relay station for the messenger service which David carried on between the workers in various parts of Palestine and adjacent regions. He did all of this on his own initiative, but with the approval of Andrew. David employed 40 to 50 messengers in this intelligence division of the rapidly enlarging and extending work of the kingdom. While thus employed, he partially supported himself by spending some of his time at his old work of fishing. 1. The widespread fame of Jesus. By the time the camp at Bethsaida had been broken up, the fame of Jesus, particularly as a healer, had spread to all parts of Palestine and through all of Syria and the surrounding countries. For weeks after they left Bethsaida, the sick continued to arrive, and when they did not find the Master, on learning from David where he was, they would go in search of him. On this tour, Jesus did not deliberately perform any so-called miracles of healing. Nevertheless, scores of afflicted found restoration of health and happiness as a result of the reconstructive power of the intense faith which impelled them to seek for healing. There began to appear about the time of this mission, and continued throughout the remainder of Jesus' life on earth, a peculiar and unexplained series of healing phenomena. In the course of this 3 months' tour, more than 100 men, women, and children from Judea, Idumea, Galilee, Syria, Tyre, and Sidon, and from beyond the Jordan, were beneficiaries of this unconscious healing by Jesus and, returning to their homes, added to the enlargement of Jesus' fame. And they did this notwithstanding that Jesus would, every time he observed one of these cases of spontaneous healing, directly charge the beneficiary to tell no man. It was never revealed to us just what occurred in these cases of spontaneous or unconscious healing. The Master never explained to his apostles how these healings were effected, other than that on several occasions he merely said, "I perceive that power has gone forth from me." On one occasion he remarked when touched by an ailing child, "I perceive that life has gone forth from me." In the absence of direct word from the Master regarding the nature of these cases of spontaneous healing, it would be presuming on our part to undertake to explain how they were accomplished, but it will be permissible to record our opinion of all such healing phenomena. We believe that many of these apparent miracles of healing, as they occurred in the course of Jesus' earth ministry, were the result of the coexistence of the following three powerful, potent, and associated influences. 1. The presence of strong, dominant, and living faith in the heart of the human being who persistently sought healing, together with the fact that such healing was desired for its spiritual benefits rather than for purely physical restoration. 2. The existence, concomitant with such human faith, of the great sympathy and compassion of the incarnated and mercy-dominated Creator Son of God, who actually possessed in his person almost unlimited and timeless creative healing powers and prerogatives. 3. Along with the faith of the creature and the life of the Creator, it should also be noted that this God-man was the personified expression of the Father's will. If in the contact of the human need and the divine power to meet it, the Father did not will otherwise, the two became one, and the healing occurred unconsciously to the human Jesus, but was immediately recognized by his divine nature. The explanation, then, of many of these cases of healing must be found in a great law which has long been known to us, namely, what the Creator Son desires and the Eternal Father wills, is. It is, then, our opinion that, in the personal presence of Jesus, certain forms of profound human faith were literally and truly compelling in the manifestation of healing by certain creative forces and personalities of the universe, who were at that time so intimately associated with the Son of Man. It therefore becomes a fact of record that Jesus did frequently suffer men to heal themselves in his presence by their powerful, personal faith. Many others sought healing for wholly selfish purposes. A rich widow of Tyre, with her retinue, came seeking to be healed of her infirmities, which were many, and as she followed Jesus about through Galilee, she continued to offer more and more money, as if the power of God were something to be purchased by the highest bidder. But never would she become interested in the gospel of the kingdom. It was only the cure of her physical ailments that she sought.
2, Attitude of the People. Jesus understood the minds of men. He knew what was in the heart of man, and had his teachings been left as he presented them, the only commentary being the inspired interpretation afforded by his earth life, all nations and all religions of the world would speedily have embraced the gospel of the kingdom. The well-meant efforts of Jesus' early followers to restate his teachings so as to make them the more acceptable to certain nations, races, and religions only resulted in making such teachings the less acceptable to all other nations, races, and religions. The Apostle Paul, in his efforts to bring the teachings of Jesus to the favorable notice of certain groups in his day, wrote many letters of instruction and admonition. Other teachers of Jesus' gospel did likewise, but none of them realized that some of these writings would subsequently be brought together by those who would set them forth as the embodiment of the teachings of Jesus. And so, while so-called Christianity does contain more of the Master's gospel than any other religion, it does also contain much that Jesus did not teach. Aside from the incorporation of many teachings from the Persian mysteries and much of the Greek philosophy into early Christianity, two great mistakes were made. 1. The effort to connect the gospel teaching directly onto the Jewish theology, as illustrated by the Christian doctrines of the atonement, the teaching that Jesus was the sacrificed Son who would satisfy the Father's stern justice and appease the divine wrath. These teachings originated in a praiseworthy effort to make the gospel of the kingdom more acceptable to disbelieving Jews. Though these efforts failed as far as winning the Jews was concerned, they did not fail to confuse and alienate many honest souls in all subsequent generations. 2. The second great blunder of the Master's early followers, and one which all subsequent generations have persisted in perpetuating, was to organize the Christian teaching so completely about the person of Jesus. This overemphasis of the personality of Jesus in the theology of Christianity has worked to obscure his teachings, and all of this has made it increasingly difficult for Jews, Mohammedans, Hindus, and other Eastern religionists to accept the teaching of Jesus. We would not belittle the place of the person of Jesus in a religion which might bear his name, but we would not permit such consideration to eclipse his inspired life or to supplant his saving message, the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man. The teachers of the religion of Jesus should approach other religions with a recognition of the truths which are held in common, many of which come directly or indirectly from Jesus' message, while they refrain from placing so much emphasis on the differences. While, at that particular time, the fame of Jesus rested chiefly upon his reputation as a healer, it does not follow that it continued so to rest. As time passed, more and more he was sought for spiritual help. But it was the physical cures that made the most direct and immediate appeal to the common people. Jesus was increasingly sought by the victims of moral enslavement and mental harassments, and he invariably taught them the way of deliverance. Fathers sought his advice regarding the management of their sons, and mothers came for help in the guidance of their daughters. Those who sat in darkness came to him, and he revealed to them the light of life. His ear was ever open to the sorrows of mankind, and he always helped those who sought his ministry. When the Creator himself was on earth, incarnated in the likeness of mortal flesh, it was inevitable that some extraordinary things would happen. But you should never approach Jesus through these so-called miraculous occurrences. Learn to approach the miracle through Jesus, but do not make the mistake of approaching Jesus through the miracle. And this admonition is warranted, notwithstanding that Jesus of Nazareth is the only founder of a religion who performed supermaterial acts on earth. The most astonishing and the most revolutionary feature of Michael's mission on earth was his attitude toward women. In a day and generation when a man was not supposed to salute even his own wife in a public place, Jesus dared to take women along as teachers of the gospel in connection with his third tour of Galilee. And he had the consummate courage to do this in the face of the rabbinic teaching which declared that it was better that the words of the law should be burned than delivered to women. In one generation, Jesus lifted women out of the disrespectful oblivion and the slavish drudgery of the ages. And it is the one shameful thing about the religion that presumed to take Jesus' name that it lacked the moral courage to follow this noble example in its subsequent attitude toward women. As Jesus mingled with the people, they found him entirely free from the superstitions of that day. He was free from religious prejudices. He was never intolerant. He had nothing in his heart resembling social antagonism. While he complied with the good in the religion of his fathers, he did not hesitate to disregard man-made traditions of superstition and bondage. He dared to teach that catastrophes of nature, accidents of time, and other calamitous happenings are not visitations of divine judgments or mysterious dispensations of providence. He denounced slavish devotion to meaningless ceremonials and exposed the fallacy of materialistic worship. He boldly proclaimed man's spiritual freedom and dared to teach that mortals of the flesh are indeed and in truth sons of the living God. Jesus transcended all the teachings of his forebears when he boldly substituted clean hearts for clean hands as the mark of true religion. He put reality in the place of tradition and swept aside all pretensions of vanity and hypocrisy. And yet this fearless man of God did not give vent to destructive criticism or manifest an utter disregard of the religious, social, economic, and political usages of his day. He was not a militant revolutionist. He was a progressive evolutionist. He engaged in the destruction of that which was only when he simultaneously offered his fellows the superior thing which ought to be. Jesus received the obedience of his followers without exacting it. Only three men who received his personal call refused to accept the invitation to discipleship. He exercised a peculiar drawing power over men, but he was not dictatorial. He commanded confidence, and no man ever resented his giving a command. He assumed absolute authority over his disciples, but no one ever objected. He permitted his followers to call him Master. The Master was admired by all who met him, except those who entertained deep-seated religious prejudices or those who thought they discerned political dangers in his teachings. Men were astonished at the originality and authoritativeness of his teaching. They marveled at his patience in dealing with backward and troublesome inquirers. He inspired hope and confidence in the hearts of all who came under his ministry. Only those who had not met him feared him, and he was hated only by those who regarded him as the champion of that truth which was destined to overthrow the evil and error which they had determined to hold in their hearts at all cost. On both friends and foes he exercised a strong and peculiarly fascinating influence. Multitudes would follow him for weeks just to hear his gracious words and behold his simple life. Devoted men and women loved Jesus with a well-nigh superhuman affection, and the better they knew him, the more they loved him. And all this is still true. Even today and in all future ages, the more man comes to know this God-man, the more he will love and follow after him.
Whatever really happened, however it happened, Jesus' friends and foes alike were in agreement. They believed Jesus was a miracle worker.
But it wasn't just his ability to do these things which so astonished them. After all, first century Palestine was full of magicians and wonder workers. What people questioned was the meaning of his miracles, and that's what I want to find out. If the miracles of Jesus were signs, then what were they saying to people in the first century? And can they answer a question so vital that people have lived and died for it for centuries? Who was Jesus?
So far in this series, I've discovered that through his miracles, Jesus was seen as a long-awaited savior. Some showed him as a prophet, like Moses, heralding a new age of peace and prosperity. Others revealed him as the Messiah, the mighty warrior who would set the Jews free from Roman occupation.
But in one particular miracle, there's a glimpse of a third possibility, that Jesus was someone far greater than either a Jewish holy man or even the Messiah. Jesus and the disciples were on one of their many trips on the Sea of Galilee when the Gospels say they were hit by an unexpected and violent crisis. In fact, this part of the story does appear to be accurate because eastern storms do blow up regularly here on the Sea of Galilee. The disciples were struggling for their lives. But by comparison, Jesus' reaction is bewildering. He's said to have been asleep. And when awoken, his response couldn't have been less reassuring. But what the disciples didn't know was that they were about to receive help in a way they could never have imagined. Jesus stood up and rebuked the wind and sea. The disciples must have wondered who on earth Jesus was. This man who appeared able to control the elements. But just as with other miracles, what amazed them was not what Jesus did, it was what it revealed about his identity. They would have known the ancient Jewish prophecies which said very clearly that there was only one person who could calm the stormy seas. God. One passage from the book of Psalms recalls an occasion where God had shown his power to save his people from distress. In exactly the same way as Jesus had on the Sea of Galilee, by stilling a storm. The similarities would not have been lost on the disciples. Jesus' actions seem to suggest that he had the power of God himself. And that's certainly the traditional Christian view. For centuries, the church has taught that Jesus is divine, and that miracles like the stilling of the storm prove it. But many scholars have argued that this miracle never even happened. That it's so spectacular, it must have been invented by the gospel writers to suggest that Jesus was the Son of God. It's difficult to know where the truth really lies. But I want to look beyond the official teachings of the church to try and work out who Jesus himself thought he was. Could he have believed he was the Son of God? And that means looking at both his words and his deeds, and examining some of his less contentious miracles. It's not going to be easy, because Jesus was constantly talking in riddles and acting symbolically. But when you look at the Gospels, there are signs that right from the beginning of his ministry, he was consciously acting in a forbidden way, which suggests he believed his relationship with God was unlike that of any other Jew in history.
So now, let's listen to the New Testament's version of this exact same situation of the stilling of the tempest or the storm. It's outlined in Matthew 8, verses 23 to 27, Mark 4, 35 to 41, and Luke 8, 23 to 25. Then we'll listen to the Urantia Papers version of paper 151, section 5 and 6.
Chapter 66. Jesus stills the storm. Later on, when it was about sunset, there was a great crowd gathered around Jesus. The crowd was pressing Jesus, and so Jesus got into a boat with his disciples and told them to take the boat to the other side of the sea. As they were preparing to shove off and go to the other side of the lake, a scribe came up to Jesus and said, "Teacher, I will follow you wherever you go." And Jesus said to him, "The foxes have dens, and the birds of the heaven have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head." Following this, one of his disciples said to him, "Allow me to go bury my Father." But Jesus said to him, "Follow me, and let the spiritually dead bury their own dead." Jesus then entered the boat that the disciples had prepared and began to travel to the other side of the lake. They left the multitude on the shore, and as the boat sailed off toward the other shore, Jesus fell asleep in the boat. While Jesus slept, a great windstorm arose on the lake. The waves began to beat against the boat and fill it up with water. The disciples became very afraid to the point of thinking that they would all be lost in the storm, except for Jesus, who lay asleep at the back of the boat. The disciples came to Jesus and woke him up, saying, "Lord, we are perishing." And Jesus stood up and rebuked the wind and the sea and the raging water. He said to the sea, "Peace be still." And the storm ceased, and there was a great calm. And then Jesus said to his disciples, "Why are you so fearful? Don't you have faith yet? Oh, you of little faith." And the disciples, still afraid, began to marvel, saying to one another, "Who is this man that even the wind and the seas obey him?"
5. The visit to Chorazza. The multitude continued to increase throughout the week. On Sabbath, Jesus hastened away to the hills, but when Sunday morning came, the crowds returned. Jesus spoke to them in the early afternoon, after the preaching of Peter, and when he had finished, he said to his apostles, "I am weary of the throngs. Let us cross over to the other side, that we may rest for a day." On the way across the lake, they encountered one of those violent and sudden windstorms which are characteristic of the Sea of Galilee, especially at this season of the year. This body of water is almost 700 feet below the level of the sea, and is surrounded by high banks, especially on the west. There are steep gorges leading up from the lake into the hills, and as the heated air rises in a pocket over the lake during the day, there is a tendency after sunset for the cooling air of the gorges to rush down upon the lake. These gales come on quickly and sometimes go away just as suddenly. It was just such an evening gale that caught the boat carrying Jesus over to the other side on this Sunday evening. Three other boats containing some of the younger evangelists were trailing after. This tempest was severe, notwithstanding that it was confined to this region of the lake, there being no evidence of a storm on the western shore. The wind was so strong that the waves began to wash over the boat. The high wind had torn the sail away before the apostles could furl it, and they were now entirely dependent on their oars as they laboriously pulled for the shore, a little more than a mile and a half distant. Meanwhile, Jesus lay asleep in the stern of the boat under a small overhead shelter. The Master was weary when they left Bethsaida, and it was to secure rest that he had directed them to sail him across to the other side. These ex-fishermen were strong and experienced oarsmen, but this was one of the worst gales they had ever encountered. Although the wind and the waves tossed their boat about as though it were a toy ship, Jesus slumbered on, undisturbed. Peter was at the right-hand oar near the stern. When the boat began to fill with water, he dropped his oar and, rushing over to Jesus, shook him vigorously in order to awaken him. And when he was aroused, Peter said, "Master, don't you know we are in a violent storm? If you do not save us, we will all perish." As Jesus came out in the rain, he looked first at Peter, and then peering into the darkness at the struggling oarsmen, he turned his glance back upon Simon Peter, who in his agitation had not yet returned to his oar, and said, "Why are all of you so filled with fear? Where is your faith? Peace, be quiet." Jesus had hardly uttered this rebuke to Peter and the other apostles. He had hardly bidden Peter seek peace wherewith to quiet his troubled soul, when the disturbed atmosphere, having established its equilibrium, settled down into a great calm. The angry waves almost immediately subsided, while the dark clouds, having spent themselves in a short shower, vanished, and the stars of heaven shone overhead. All this was purely coincidental, as far as we can judge, but the apostles, particularly Simon Peter, never ceased to regard the episode as a nature miracle. It was especially easy for the men of that day to believe in nature miracles, inasmuch as they firmly believed that all nature was a phenomenon directly under the control of spirit forces and supernatural beings. Jesus plainly explained to the 12 that he had spoken to their troubled spirits and had addressed himself to their fear-tossed minds, that he had not commanded the elements to obey his word, but it was of no avail. The Master's followers always persisted in placing their own interpretation on all such coincidental occurrences. From this day on, they insisted on regarding the Master as having absolute power over the natural elements. Peter never grew weary of reciting how even the winds and the waves obey him. It was late in the evening when Jesus and his associates reached the shore, and since it was a calm and beautiful night, they all rested in the boats, not going ashore until shortly after sunrise the next morning. When they were gathered together, about 40 in all, Jesus said, "Let us go up into yonder hills and tarry for a few days, while we ponder over the problems of the Father's kingdom."
And that brings us to miracle number 14, known in Luke as the Gerasene demoniac. This is found also in Matthew 8, verses 28 to 34, Mark 5, 1 to 20, and Luke 8, 26 to 39. The Urantia papers will follow this up from paper 151, section 6. Let's listen to this.
Chapter 67. Jesus heals two demoniacs. After the storm, they came to the other side of the lake, to a region of the country called the Gadarenes. And as Jesus and his disciples came out of the boat, they were met by some men who came out of the caves and from among the tombs. These men had unclean spirits, and they had great power over them, so great that even when these men had been bound with chains, they were able to break the chains. No man was strong enough to tame these men possessed of demons. They spent their time living among the tombs and crying out and doing harm to themselves by cutting themselves with stones. They wore no clothes. When they saw Jesus, they ran to him and fell down before him and worshipped him. They cried out with a loud voice and said, "What do we have to do with you, Jesus, Son of the Most High God?" As Jesus was commanding the unclean spirits to come out, they begged Jesus not to torment them. Jesus asked them, "What is your name?" "My name is Legion, for we are many." The demons begged Jesus not to send them out of the country, and they begged Jesus not to send them to the abyss. Now off in the distance was a great herd of swine feeding. The demons begged to enter the swine, saying, "If you do cast us out, send us into the herd of swine." Jesus told them to go, and they came out of the men and entered into the herd of about 2,000 swine. And once this happened, the entire herd of swine rushed down the steep cliffs and hurled themselves into the sea and drowned. When the herdsmen that kept the swine saw what had happened, they fled to the city and told everyone in the city and the countryside what they had witnessed. Those that lived in the city came to see what had happened, and they came to Jesus and found the men that had been possessed by the unclean spirits, sitting on the ground clothed and in their right minds. The herdsmen told how the demons had possessed the swine, and how they had cast themselves into the sea and drowned. And they told the men from the city how those that had been filled with the unclean spirits had been made whole, and they were afraid. And all the people of the city of the Gadarenes began to ask Jesus to leave their country, for they were full of fear. Jesus and his disciples began to head toward the boat in order to leave. One of the men who had been possessed by an unclean spirit begged Jesus to come along with him. But Jesus told him that he could not come with him, but that he must return to his home and his friends to tell them the great things that God had done for him, and how God had shown him great mercy. The man went his way, publishing throughout the entire city the great things that Jesus had done for him. And he began to publish in Decapolis the great things that Jesus had done for him. and everyone that heard it marveled. As Jesus crossed over the sea to the other side, a great multitude was waiting for him by the shore. They welcomed Jesus as he returned, because they had been there all that time waiting for him to come back.
6. The Caressa Lunatic. Although most of the nearby eastern shore of the lake sloped up gently to the highlands beyond, at this particular spot there was a steep hillside, the shore in some places dropping sheer down into the lake. Pointing up to the side of the nearby hill, Jesus said, "Let us go up on this hillside for our breakfast, and under some of the shelters rest and talk." This entire hillside was covered with caverns which had been hewn out of the rock. Many of these niches were ancient sepulchres. About halfway up the hillside, on a small, relatively level spot, was the cemetery of the little village of Caressa. As Jesus and his associates passed near this burial ground, a lunatic who lived in these hillside caverns rushed up to them. This demented man was well known about these parts, having one time been bound with fetters and chains and confined in one of the grottos. Long since he had broken his shackles and now roamed at will among the tombs and abandoned sepulchres. This man, whose name was Amos, was afflicted with a periodic form of insanity. There were considerable spells when he would find some clothing and deport himself fairly well among his fellows. During one of these lucid intervals, he had gone over to Bethsaida, where he heard the preaching of Jesus and the apostles, and at that time had become a half-hearted believer in the gospel of the kingdom. But soon a stormy phase of his trouble appeared, and he fled to the tombs, where he moaned, cried out aloud, and so conducted himself as to terrorize all who chanced to meet him. When Amos recognized Jesus, he fell down at his feet and exclaimed, "I know you, Jesus, but I am possessed of many devils, and I beseech that you will not torment me." This man truly believed that his periodic mental affliction was due to the fact that, at such times, evil or unclean spirits entered into him and dominated his mind and body. His troubles were mostly emotional. His brain was not grossly diseased. Jesus, looking down upon the man crouching like an animal at his feet, reached down and, taking him by the hand, stood him up and said to him, "Amos, you are not possessed of a devil. You have already heard the good news that you are a son of God. I command you to come out of this spell." And when Amos heard Jesus speak these words, there occurred such a transformation in his intellect that he was immediately restored to his right mind and the normal control of his emotions. By this time a considerable crowd had assembled from the nearby village, and these people, augmented by the swineherders from the highland above them, were astonished to see the lunatic sitting with Jesus and his followers, in possession of his right mind, and freely conversing with them. As the swineherders rushed into the village to spread the news of the taming of the lunatic, the dogs charged upon a small and untended herd of about 30 swine and drove most of them over a precipice into the sea. And it was this incidental occurrence, in connection with the presence of Jesus and the supposed miraculous curing of the lunatic, that gave origin to the legend that Jesus had cured Amos by casting a legion of devils out of him, and that these devils had entered into the herd of swine, causing them forthwith to rush headlong to their destruction in the sea below. Before the day was over, this episode was published abroad by the swine tenders, and the whole village believed it. Amos most certainly believed this story. He saw the swine tumbling over the brow of the hill shortly after his troubled mind had quieted down, and he always believed that they carried with them the very evil spirits which had so long tormented and afflicted him. And this had a good deal to do with the permanency of his cure. It is equally true that all of Jesus' apostles, save Thomas, believed that the episode of the swine was directly connected with the cure of Amos. Jesus did not obtain the rest he was looking for. Most of that day he was thronged by those who came in response to the word that Amos had been cured, and who were attracted by the story that the demons had gone out of the lunatic into the herd of swine. And so, after only one night of rest, early Tuesday morning, Jesus and his friends were awakened by a delegation of these swine-raising Gentiles, who had come to urge that he depart from their midst. Said their spokesman to Peter and Andrew, "Fishermen of Galilee, depart from us, and take your prophet with you. We know he is a holy man, but the gods of our country do not know him, and we stand in danger of losing many swine. The fear of you has descended upon us, so that we pray you to go hence." And when Jesus heard them, he said to Andrew, "Let us return to our place." As they were about to depart, Amos besought Jesus to permit him to go back with them, but the master would not consent. Said Jesus to Amos, "Forget not that you are a son of God. Return to your own people and show them what great things God has done for you." And Amos went about publishing that Jesus had cast a legion of devils out of his troubled soul, and that these evil spirits had entered into a herd of swine, driving them to quick destruction. And he did not stop until he had gone into all the cities of the Decapolis, declaring what great things Jesus had done for him. Paper 152, Events Leading Up to the Capernaum Crisis. The story of the cure of Amos, the Gerasa lunatic, had already reached Bethsaida and Capernaum, so that a great crowd was waiting for Jesus when his boat landed that Tuesday forenoon. Among this throng were the new observers from the Jerusalem Sanhedrin, who had come down to Capernaum to find cause for the master's apprehension and conviction. As Jesus spoke with those who had assembled to greet him, Jairus, one of the rulers of the synagogue, made his way through the crowd and, falling down at his feet, took him by the hand and besought that he would hasten away with him, saying, "Master, my little daughter, an only child, lies in my home at the point of death. I pray that you will come and heal her." When Jesus heard the request of this father, he said, "I will go with you." As Jesus went along with Jairus, the large crowd which had heard the father's request followed on to see what would happen. Shortly before they reached the ruler's house, as they hastened through a narrow street and as the throng jostled him, Jesus suddenly stopped, exclaiming, "Someone touched me." And when those who were near him denied that they had touched him, Peter spoke up, "Master, you can see that this crowd presses you, threatening to crush us, and yet you say, 'Someone has touched me.' What do you mean?" Then Jesus said, "I asked who touched me, for I perceived that living energy had gone forth from me." As Jesus looked about him, his eyes fell upon a nearby woman who, coming forward, knelt at his feet and said, "For years I have been afflicted with a scourging hemorrhage. I have suffered many things from many physicians. I have spent all my substance, but none could cure me. Then I heard of you, and I thought if I may but touch the hem of his garment, I shall certainly be made whole. And so I pressed forward with the crowd as it moved along until, standing near you, Master, I touched the border of your garment, and I was made whole. I know that I have been healed of my affliction." When Jesus heard this, he took the woman by the hand, and lifting her up, said, "Daughter, your faith has made you whole. Go in peace." It was her faith, and not her touch, that made her whole. And this case is a good illustration of many apparently miraculous cures which attended upon Jesus' earth career, but which he, in no sense, consciously willed. The passing of time demonstrated that this woman was really cured of her malady. Her faith was of the sort that laid direct hold upon the creative power resident in the Master's person. With the faith she had, it was only necessary to approach the Master's person. It was not at all necessary to touch his garment. That was merely the superstitious part of her belief. Jesus called this woman, Veronica of Caesarea Philippi, into his presence to correct two errors which might have lingered in her mind, or which might have persisted in the minds of those who witnessed this healing. He did not want Veronica to go away thinking that her fear in attempting to steal her cure had been honored, or that her superstition in associating the touch of his garment with her healing had been effective. He desired all to know that it was her pure and living faith that had wrought the cure. 1. At Jairus' house. Jairus was, of course, terribly impatient of this delay in reaching his home, so they now hastened on at quickened pace. Even before they entered the ruler's yard, one of his servants came out saying, "Trouble not the master, your daughter is dead." But Jesus seemed not to heed the servant's words, for taking with him Peter, James, and John, he turned and said to the grief-stricken father, "Fear not, only believe." When he entered the house, he found the flute players already there with the mourners, who were making an unseemly tumult. Already were the relatives engaged in weeping and wailing. And when he had put all the mourners out of the room, he went in with the father and mother and his three apostles. He had told the mourners that the damsel was not dead, but they laughed him to scorn. Jesus now turned to the mother, saying, "Your daughter is not dead, she is only asleep." And when the house had quieted down, Jesus, going up to where the child lay, took her by the hand and said, "Daughter, I say to you, awake and arise." And when the girl heard these words, she immediately rose up and walked across the room. And presently, after she had recovered from her daze, Jesus directed that they should give her something to eat, for she had been a long time without food. Since there was much agitation in Capernaum against Jesus, he called the family together and explained that the maiden had been in a state of coma following a long fever, and that he had merely aroused her, that he had not raised her from the dead. He likewise explained all this to his apostles, but it was futile. They all believed he had raised the little girl from the dead. What Jesus said in explanation of many of these apparent miracles had little effect on his followers. They were miracle-minded and lost no opportunity to ascribe another wonder to Jesus. Jesus and the apostles returned to Bethsaida after he had specifically charged all of them that they should tell no man. When he came out of Jairus' house, two blind men led by a dumb boy followed him and cried out for healing. About this time, Jesus' reputation as a healer was at its very height. Everywhere he went, the sick and the afflicted were waiting for him. The master now looked much worn, and all of his friends were becoming concerned lest he continue his work of teaching and healing to the point of actual collapse. Jesus' apostles, let alone the common people, could not understand the nature and attributes of this God-man. Neither has any subsequent generation been able to evaluate what took place on earth in the person of Jesus of Nazareth. And there never can occur an opportunity for either science or religion to check up on these remarkable events for the simple reason that such an extraordinary situation can never again occur, either on this world or on any other world in Nevadon. Never again on any world in this entire universe will a being appear in the likeness of mortal flesh, at the same time embodying all the attributes of creative energy combined with spiritual endowments which transcend time and most other material limitations. Never before Jesus was on earth, nor since, has it been possible so directly and graphically to secure the results attendant upon the strong and living faith of mortal men and women. To repeat these phenomena, we would have to go into the immediate presence of Michael, the Creator, and find him as he was in those days, the Son of Man. Likewise, today, while his absence prevents such material manifestations, you should refrain from placing any sort of limitation on the possible exhibition of his spiritual power. Though the Master is absent as a material being, he is present as a spiritual influence in the hearts of men. By going away from the world, Jesus made it possible for his spirit to live alongside that of his Father, which indwells the minds of all mankind.
This brings us to one of the most well-known of Jesus' miracles, Miracle 16, the feeding of the 5,000. This is to be found in Matthew 14, verses 13 to 23, Mark 6, 30 to 46, and Luke 9, verses 10 to 17. It's also found in John 6, 1 to 15. This is one of the few miracles that are found in all four of the Gospels. It's also found in paper 152 of the Urantia Papers, section 2. Let's have a listen.
Right from the outset, the miracles reveal a very different picture of Jesus. Not the meek and mild teacher dispensing acts of kindness, but a prophet who uses the miracles to rebuke his people for their sins. So, is this the key to the miracles? Are they designed to show Jesus as some kind of prophet from the Old Testament? Well, it's not that simple.
The raising of the widow's son is only one of the many miracles credited to Jesus. Other miracles would paint him in an altogether different light. There is one miracle which hints at an even more dangerous possibility. It's one of the most spectacular miracles attributed to Jesus. The feeding of the 5,000. It's also known as the miracle of the loaves and fishes, and like all the miracles, it is full of allusions and surprising meanings.
pilgrims from all over the world come to Galilee, and they want to know where the miracle of the feeding of the 5,000 took place. The Church of the Loaves and Fishes on the northwestern shore over there traditionally marks the spot where it's supposed to have happened. But there are clues in the Gospels which suggest it took place somewhere else altogether. The Gospels say that the crowds left the fishing village of Bethsaida on the Jordan Delta and made their way to a deserted place. Now, Bethsaida no longer exists, but the ruins of the village were recently found just over there amongst the trees. And as for a deserted place, well, the Golan Heights, which even to this day are some of the bleakest and emptiest parts of the Galilee, are beyond them, just over there. So that whole area between the ruins of Bethsaida and the Golan Heights is the most likely place for the miracle of the feeding of the 5,000. According to the Gospels, 5,000 people from several villages gathered here. Now that might seem like an impossibly large number, but even today, vast crowds are drawn to different religious festivals. Take the Hajj, the annual Muslim pilgrimage to Mecca, where 2 million people gather in one place. And we know from the writings of the first century historian Josephus that 100,000 observant Jews would regularly travel to Jerusalem on pilgrimage. So perhaps a crowd of 5,000 is not so unlikely. The Gospels say that when Jesus arrived to speak, he ran into trouble. The people were hungry. Jesus told the disciples to get the crowd to sit down in groups of 50s and 100s and to gather what food was available. All they had were 5 loaves and 2 fishes, hardly enough to feed a multitude of 5,000. It would take a miracle to feed them all. Kept on coming. The Gospels say all 5,000 ate and were filled. So much so, there was enough left over to fill 12 baskets. It's natural to wonder if and how the miracle really happened.
There's one theory that the crowds were whipped into a frenzy of religious fervor that suppressed their hunger. Another says that the crowds were so inspired by Jesus, they spontaneously shared their meager bits of food. Then again, if you believe that God exists, why couldn't such a thing take place? Whatever you think, the point is that people back then believed Jesus had fed the multitude. More than that, they would have recognized the symbolism of the miracle. Today, the miracle of the feeding of the 5,000 is generally taken to signify God's bountiful gifts to his people. That's the modern interpretation. But it would have had a completely different meaning to first century Jews, one so remarkable many could hardly believe it was true. Again, Jesus seemed to be acting like someone else they'd been longing for. Everything about the miracle would have brought to mind the greatest figure in ancient Jewish history. The Prince of Egypt, who saved the Israelites from the Pharaoh. Father of the Jewish faith himself, Moses. To understand why the miracle of the feeding of the 5,000 was a symbol of Moses, we need to look deeper into the hopes of first century Jews.
We've already seen how Jews at the time of Jesus were awaiting a great prophet, but this would only be the first part of what would be a massive upheaval. The Dead Sea Scrolls tell us they were also awaiting a military savior. They called him the Messiah, and his task would be to liberate the Jews from Roman oppression.
The people had a pretty good idea of the kind of savior they were expecting. The scroll said it would be someone with the leadership qualities of Moses, the hero of the Exodus. The Bible says that 1,300 years earlier, Moses had led the Israelites out of slavery in Egypt. After crossing the Red Sea, he led his people into the Sinai Desert. And having spent 40 years in the wilderness, he marched them towards the Promised Land. It was a tough act for anyone to follow. So what made them think that Jesus could be another Moses? Well, there are many similarities between the two. Take the route of the Exodus. Moses fled the fertile lands of the Nile Delta. He then crossed a sea, the Red Sea, and headed east for a deserted area, the wilderness of Sinai. Now look at the route Jesus took before he fed the multitude. He left from Bethsaida on the fertile lands of the Jordan Delta. He then crossed a sea, the Sea of Galilee, and headed east for a deserted area, the Golan Heights. Coincidence? Maybe. But then take a look at these other oddly similar details. Moses was the leader of a people and an army. He often ordered the Hebrews to sit down in military companies of 50 and 100. Just before Jesus works his miracle, he too seems to act in the manner of a general. And he orders the crowd to sit in groups of 50 and 100. But the most striking similarity is in the miracle itself. Remember how Jesus multiplied bread and fishes to feed a multitude? Well, there was a miraculous multiplication of food in the Sinai desert too. Every day Moses prayed to God to feed his hungry people. One evening, his prayers were answered. The skies were said to be swarming with quails.
Two, feeding the 5,000. Jesus continued to teach the people by day, while he instructed the apostles and evangelists at night. On Friday, he declared a furlough of 1 week, that all his followers might go home or to their friends for a few days before preparing to go up to Jerusalem for the Passover. But more than one half of his disciples refused to leave him, and the multitude was daily increasing in size, so much so that David Zebedee desired to establish a new encampment, but Jesus refused consent. The master had so little rest over the Sabbath that on Sunday morning, March 27, he sought to get away from the people. Some of the evangelists were left to talk to the multitude while Jesus and the 12 planned to escape, unnoticed, to the opposite shore of the lake, where they proposed to obtain much-needed rest in a beautiful park south of Bethsaida Julius. This region was a favorite resorting place for Capernaum folks. They were all familiar with these parks on the eastern shore. But the people would not have it so. They saw the direction taken by Jesus' boat, and hiring every craft available, they started out in pursuit. Those who could not obtain boats fared forth on foot to walk around the upper end of the lake. By late afternoon, more than 1,000 persons had located the master in one of the parks, and he spoke to them briefly, being followed by Peter. Many of these people had brought food with them, and after eating the evening meal, they gathered about in small groups while Jesus' apostles and disciples taught them. Monday afternoon, the multitude had increased to more than 3,000, and still, way into the evening, the people continued to flock in, bringing all manner of sick folks with them. Hundreds of interested persons had made their plans to stop over at Capernaum to see and hear Jesus on their way to the Passover, and they simply refused to be disappointed. By Wednesday noon, about 5,000 men, women, and children were assembled here in this park to the south of Bethsaida Julius. The weather was pleasant, it being near the end of the rainy season in this locality. Philip had provided a 3 days' supply of food for Jesus and the 12, which was in the custody of the Mark lad, their boy of all chores. By afternoon of this, the third day for almost half of this multitude, the food the people had brought with them was nearly exhausted. David Zebedee had no tented city here to feed and accommodate the crowds. Neither had Philip made food provision for such a multitude, but the people, even though they were hungry, would not go away. It was being quietly whispered about that Jesus, desiring to avoid trouble with both Herod and the Jerusalem leaders, had chosen this quiet spot outside the jurisdiction of all his enemies as the proper place to be crowned king. The enthusiasm of the people was rising every hour. Not a word was said to Jesus, though, of course, he knew all that was going on. Even the 12 apostles were still tainted with such notions, and especially the younger evangelists. The apostles who favored this attempt to proclaim Jesus king were Peter, John, Simon Zelotes, and Judas Iscariot. Those opposing the plan were Andrew, James, Nathanael, and Thomas. Matthew, Philip, and the Alphaeus twins were noncommittal. The ringleader of this plot to make him king was Joab, one of the young evangelists. This was the stage setting about 5 o'clock on Wednesday afternoon, when Jesus asked James Alphaeus to summon Andrew and Philip. Said Jesus, "What shall we do with the multitude? They have been with us now 3 days, and many of them are hungry. they have no food. Philip and Andrew exchanged glances, and then Philip answered, Master, you should send these people away so that they may go to the villages around about and buy themselves food. And Andrew, fearing the materialization of the king plot, quickly joined with Philip, saying, Yes, Master, I think it best that you dismiss the multitude so that they may go their way and buy food while you secure rest for a season. By this time, others of the 12 had joined the conference. Then said Jesus, But I do not desire to send them away hungry. Can you not feed them? This was too much for Philip, and he spoke right up. Master, in this country place, where can we buy bread for this multitude? 200 denarii worth would not be enough for lunch. Before the apostles had an opportunity to express themselves, Jesus turned to Andrew and Philip, saying, I do not want to send these people away. Here they are like sheep without a shepherd. I would like to feed them. What food have we with us? While Philip was conversing with Matthew and Judas, Andrew sought out the Mark lad to ascertain how much was left of their store of provisions. He returned to Jesus, saying, The lad has left only 5 barley loaves and 2 dried fishes. And Peter promptly added, We have yet to eat this evening. For a moment, Jesus stood in silence. There was a faraway look in his eyes. The apostles said nothing. Jesus turned suddenly to Andrew and said, Bring me the loaves and fishes. And when Andrew had brought the basket to Jesus, the master said, Direct the people to sit down on the grass in companies of 100, and appoint a leader over each group while you bring all of the evangelists here with us. Jesus took up the loaves in his hands, and after he had given thanks, he broke the bread and gave to his apostles, who passed it on to their associates, who in turn carried it to the multitude. Jesus in like manner broke and distributed the fishes. And this multitude did eat and were filled. And when they had finished eating, Jesus said to the disciples, Gather up the broken pieces that remain over, so that nothing will be lost. And when they had finished gathering up the fragments, they had 12 basketfuls. They who ate of this extraordinary feast numbered about 5,000 men, women, and children. And this is the first and only nature miracle which Jesus performed as a result of his conscious pre-planning. It is true that his disciples were disposed to call many things miracles which were not, but this was a genuine supernatural ministration. In this case, so we were taught, Michael multiplied food elements as he always does, except for the elimination of the time factor and the visible life channel. 3. The King-Making Episode. The feeding of the 5,000 by supernatural energy was another of those cases where human pity plus creative power equaled that which happened. Now that the multitude had been fed to the full, and since Jesus' fame was then and there augmented by this stupendous wonder, the project to seize the Master and proclaim him king required no further personal direction. The idea seemed to spread through the crowd like a contagion. The reaction of the multitude to this sudden and spectacular supplying of their physical needs was profound and overwhelming. For a long time the Jews had been taught that the Messiah, the son of David, when he should come, would cause the land again to flow with milk and honey, and that the bread of life would be bestowed upon them as manna from heaven was supposed to have fallen upon their forefathers in the wilderness. And was not all of this expectation now fulfilled right before their eyes? When this hungry, undernourished multitude had finished gorging itself with the wonder food, there was but one unanimous reaction, Here is our king. The wonder-working deliverer of Israel had come. In the eyes of these simple-minded people, the power to feed carried with it the right to rule. No wonder, then, that the multitude, when it had finished feasting, rose as one man and shouted, Make him king. This mighty shout enthused Peter and those of the apostles who still retained the hope of seeing Jesus assert his right to rule. But these false hopes were not to live for long. This mighty shout of the multitude had hardly ceased to reverberate from the nearby rocks when Jesus stepped upon a huge stone and, lifting up his right hand to command their attention, said, My children, you mean well, but you are short-sighted and material-minded. There was a brief pause. The stalwart Galilean was there majestically posed in the enchanting glow of that eastern twilight. Every inch he looked a king as he continued to speak to this breathless multitude. You would make me king, not because your souls have been lighted with a great truth, but because your stomachs have been filled with bread. How many times have I told you that my kingdom is not of this world? This kingdom of heaven which we proclaim is a spiritual brotherhood, and no man rules over it seated upon a material throne. My Father in heaven is the all-wise and the all-powerful ruler over this spiritual brotherhood of the sons of God on earth. Have I so failed in revealing to you the Father of spirits that you would make a king of his son in the flesh? Now, all of you go hence to your homes. If you must have a king, let the Father of lights be enthroned in the heart of each of you as the spirit ruler of all things. These words of Jesus sent the multitude away stunned and disheartened. Many who had believed in him turned back and followed him no more from that day. The apostles were speechless. They stood in silence, gathered about the 12 baskets of the fragments of food. Only the chore boy, the Mark lad, spoke, and he refused to be our king. Jesus, before going off to be alone in the hills, turned to Andrew and said, "Take your brethren back to Zebedee's house and pray with them, especially for your brother Simon Peter."
Now, probably the most well-known miracle of Jesus, and the one talked about the most or referenced the most, is the walking on water. Here, the Urantia papers explain that this was not a miracle, but in fact, just a dream that Peter had had. Now, the dream was so lifelike that Peter, for most of his life, held this to be a true event. Here, the Urantia papers explains what actually happened in paper 152, section 4. Let's end this week's session with this interesting summation.
4. Simon Peter's night vision. The apostles, without their master, sent off by themselves, entered the boat and in silence began to row toward Bethsaida on the western shore of the lake. None of the 12 was so crushed and downcast as Simon Peter. Hardly a word was spoken. They were all thinking of the master alone in the hills. Had he forsaken them? He had never before sent them all away and refused to go with them. What could all this mean? Darkness descended upon them, for there had arisen a strong and contrary wind which made progress almost impossible. As the hours of darkness and hard rowing passed, Peter grew weary and fell into a deep sleep of exhaustion. Andrew and James put him to rest on the cushioned seat in the stern of the boat. While the other apostles toiled against the wind and the waves, Peter dreamed a dream. He saw a vision of Jesus coming to them walking on the sea. When the master seemed to walk on by the boat, Peter cried out, "Save us, master, save us." And those who were in the rear of the boat heard him say some of these words. As the apparition of the night season continued in Peter's mind, he dreamed that he heard Jesus say, "Be of good cheer, it is I, be not afraid." This was like the balm of Gilead to Peter's disturbed soul. It soothed his troubled spirit, so that, in his dream, he cried out to the master, "Lord, if it is really you, bid me come and walk with you on the water." And when Peter started to walk upon the water, the boisterous waves frightened him. And as he was about to sink, he cried out, "Lord, save me." And many of the 12 heard him utter this cry. Then Peter dreamed that Jesus came to the rescue and, stretching forth his hand, took hold and lifted him up, saying, "O you of little faith, wherefore did you doubt?" In connection with the latter part of his dream, Peter arose from the seat whereon he slept and actually stepped overboard and into the water. And he awakened from his dream as Andrew, James, and John reached down and pulled him out of the sea. To Peter, this experience was always real. He sincerely believed that Jesus came to them that night. He only partially convinced John Mark, which explains why Mark left a portion of the story out of his narrative. Luke, the physician, who made careful search into these matters, concluded that the episode was a vision of Peter's, and therefore refused to give place to this story in the preparation of his narrative.
And that concludes our miracles for this episode. Join us next week as we conclude the miracles of Jesus before moving on to the parables. We'd like to thank the Cosmic Citizen. We would like to thank the Urantia Book Fellowship. We would like to thank the Bible Heritage Foundation for giving us permission to use the story of Jesus. Thank you. Join us next week for the conclusion of the miracles of Jesus as we step forward in this investigation of the story of Jesus in the investigation of the New Testament Bible. Thank you.